It is April 4th, 2008, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, the week in geek news and your questions and comments about technology.
The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
Hey, and Miles just reminded me it's actually April 5th. That's right, April 5th, and I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Welcome to GeekSpeak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KUSP.
Talk of the Bay is your source for interviews about local arts and public affairs, as well as the national issues that hit home here on the Central Coast. The Talk of the Bay team brings you in-depth analysis and discussion, including Art Studio, The Washington Report, The Sacramento Report, and the Performing Arts Calendar, Monday through Friday from 10 to 11 a.m. on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP.
GeekSpeak is supported by Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in cosmetic and family dentistry, using digital technology for less radiation, offering one-appointment crowns and veneers. For appointments and more information, 423-2447. Today, we are covering the Week in Geek News, and during the second half of the show, I'll welcome you to join our conversations. You can ask us anything you like. The numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can go to geekspeak.org right now to send us email. I'll give out that contact information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. This is GeekSpeak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me, Miles Elam, student, programmer, and political junkie. Miles?
Good morning.
And Ryder Brooks, support engineer at Sun Microsystems.
Good morning, Lab.
Good morning. Well, let's jump into the news. Miles, I'm going to start with... I want to start with some corrections. Just one correction, really. Last week, not really correction, just additional information from last week. Michael from Santa Cruz called in about a video problem between transferring videos from a PC to a Mac, and he couldn't use his camcorder connected, and it was kind of a problem, and couldn't figure out what to do, and the files, when he did transfer the files, they weren't really working. So I had suggested just opening up and editing software on the Windows machine and re-encoding until you figure something out. But Ben Jaffe, who's a regular geek on GeekSpeak, suggested that he look into an application called MPEG Stream Clip. I added the link up to the website, which, and the website's not live yet, but it will be up soon. Any case, it's a free application that works on Macintosh operating systems and on Windows application and encodes your files to a format that anything can read. So that's kind of a nice little suggestion from Ben. I also have had some corrections on, I don't know, a little bit of, you know, Miles's grammar problems, because he's so problematic with that, and and my own. For years, I've been making a simple mistake in my script, in what I say every week, and I corrected that. So I want to thank you very much for helping me out, and I can't recall who it was that helped me out on that through the email, but thank you so much. About technology, of course, is what I'm talking about. And Miles Elam, the attacks upon you last week, you want to address them on air, or should we just go with the news?
Yeah.
All right. Good. All right. First news story that I want to talk about is about iTunes, because I think it's kind of interesting. Miles, enlighten.
The fact that iTunes or Apple is now the number one U.S. music retailer.
Not online music retailer. Music retailer.
Music retailer. They've beaten out Walmart.
Wow. So that's big, because they've been crawling up the charts quickly in the last 5 years of existing, and now they are number one.
Yeah, people just find it easier to go there rather than purchase a physical CD. Just download it. And if you want a physical CD, then you burn one through iTunes.
Now, iTunes, there's software available for the Windows and Macintosh machines to run these files. So it's not like it's – I mean, I'm assuming that's a big part of their last stage of growth was getting onto Windows machines. And, of course, any iPod, if you want to use it effectively – including the iPhone, iPhone Touch, iPod Touch, you've got to use iTunes, basically. I mean, you could hack it and stuff, but basically it's an iTunes extension.
That's the subject of a European antitrust suit currently in progress, is that other MP3 players cannot be used with iTunes, and the fact that iPods cannot be used with other software easily.
And so both ways is the lawsuit? I mean, Is it, or is
as
it
far
just
as I'm
direction?
Aware, yeah, mm-hmm. that it's an interoperability issue.
Hmm. Well, I mean,
that they have such a large share of the market now that it's if you don't have that much share of the market, you can do pretty much what you want with your business and say like this only works with this little soft and this widget works with this software
and only but, if the soft and only if that widget's painted green. I mean, you can do anything you want.
Right, but the antitrust statutes that are in the U.S. are once you grow past a certain size and you are in control of the market, then what you do, things that are considered anti-competitive, have an impact on the overall market and consumer choice. And so you have to follow different rules. And
now, is that, that's
the question is whether or not Apple has crossed that threshold.
Is that a U.S. thing or European Union thing?
The U.S., the Sherman Act is where I knew it more. I'm more familiar with, mm-hmm. but the European Union has actually been more aggressive about antitrust suits.
Actually, doing anything about it?
And, yeah, in recent years.
And so they would use, of course, the U.S. laws about antitrust as a basis.
Well, they'd have their own. They'd have their own.
Okay.
Analogs.
I guess the question I have on this is, it's true that is their number one seller. They're 19% of the music selling market in the U.S. But that doesn't make them a monopoly. 19% is only a fraction. But I'm assuming the online selling, they're probably more a little higher.
Well, for online, they're blowing everyone away.
Well, are they at the 80%? Are they at that point where
I don't know,
is a monopoly? Or
I
not?
Don't know the,
yeah, I don't either.
The exact numbers on that. And yes, they have 19%. Walmart's at 15%. And if you look at a graph that's on this article, is that other is at somewhere around 38%.
Right.
And that's everyone else that's out there. So everyone else that's out there makes up a little more than a third.
Right.
Or
now,
a little more than 4/10.
The article I read about this was kind of quoting people saying that, you know, that reality is that music's been overpriced for a long time. And there's that whole argument of filler albums, meaning an album that gets released and there's two songs that people want on it and there's just other songs as well and you're paying that $15 for it.
Which has been happening since the beginning.
And there's a lot of argument of whether that's valid or not.
Records have been pressed. LPs,
sure,
yeah.
Sure, but there's also the argument that musicians will and producers will make an album that is supposed to be played as an album, not just by song. Mm-hmm. And so there's this whole question of whether, you know, what's the valid form of artwork there, you know? And if you want to release an album, you can't really do that in iTunes. It's not like you can restrict. So there's also the whole aspect that iTunes, of course, as we know right now, is the number one retailer online and the number one retailer in the U.S. for music. But they mostly cover either musicians they've produced or very popular musicians. That's their main focus. And there's other companies out there that are doing their online focusing to more, I don't know, unsigned labels and stuff, independent music, that are just as, just as viable and interesting to me. So it's here's the question.
A lot
for
of
me
them,
is,
I mean, that space for the ones that you haven't heard about so much. That isn't that the range of MySpace, going on there and having music from unknown, previously unknown labels and getting spread around.
Yeah. I would agree with that. The one that I was talking about is the eMusic, which focuses almost completely on independent music. Their sales are above and beyond even Amazon online. So there's this interesting stage where iTunes is attacking the kind of public music and making sure that all that very popular music, I should say, is they're the number one company. But there's still niches for other people. Now, of course, they could still be a monopoly. I'm not disputing that. But in any case, let's go on to the next news story. Sorry, enough talking about that. It's quite interesting. Ryder, you actually told me earlier in the week that you'd hacked. I mean, Miles and I both have iPhones, and we've been hacking them and making applications run on them and stuff. But you have a camera that
I'm not going on record about that. That's you, man.
So Miles and I have been hacking. But you hacked your camera.
I hacked my camera. I have a little Canon PowerShot, digital PowerShot SD800. I've had it for about a year now. And, I like it because it's nice, small, compact. But I've kind of always wanted like digital SLR features, yes. You know, like raw capturing. And it's been out for a while. I don't know how I didn't come across it, but I was scouring for news for this week, and I came across this article about the CHDK, is a Canon hacking development kit,
and not by Canon, I'm assuming.
Not by Canon, but it's basically there's a wiki page on it, and it's pretty much just open development. Anyone can join in. There's lots of firmwares, and at this point, they're supporting Canon cameras that have the Digic 2 or Digic 3 processor in it.
So if you want to hack your phone and you've got a Canon PowerShot or Canon, what's the class?
I believe it's PowerShots.
Yeah, PowerShots in general. Well, take a look at least. And the URL.
There's a large list.
And the URL, writer, if you give it to me, I'll get up on the website. Yeah, I can get up on my website at all. So that'll be up on geekspeak.org in a little bit. But
search for CHDK on Google, you'll find it.
So, for example, your phone, by default, you cannot save a RAW file, which is a non-modified on-camera file.
It supports video, AVI compression, and just JPEG.
That's what it came
of various qualities. Sure. So with this hack, it basically enables raw file capturing, which is a lot larger. But you could probably speak more to what.
Yeah,
actual...
I could talk more about raw, but let's not get into it completely. Right. Let me just ask you: have you tried opening a raw file in Adobe software?
No.
Haven't done that yet. It's possible that it'd be kind of difficult.
I can verify the files are a lot larger.
But then again, Canon does have an SLR version of camera that does have raw output, so you'd assume that the raw format's actually going to be the same because every manufacturer's raw is different. The other things that it does are like ISO changing, just basically be able to modify all the little tweaks and bells and whistles.
Well, really, really strong features of it is that it widely expands your shutter speed. So by default, my camera has a 1 second maximum exposure. Mm-hmm. This pushes it up to 65 seconds.
So you can take those beautiful moonscape kind of photographs.
Exactly.
And
you can tweak the ISO beyond the default range. So on the high end, it'll give you more noise, but it has a little bit of tweaks on the noise detection algorithms that it uses. Especially with the raw captures.
And the way this works is most every camera now, any digital device basically, has a firmware upgrade. And if you can upgrade it yourself, it means that it basically looks for an application to run, a binary application to run, and you can say, run that application. In this case, the application you're running is actually not a firmware upgrade. It doesn't touch your firmware at all. It just starts up an application.
Yeah. I mean, it loads as a firmware update. I mean, the menu interface for loading it, and you can auto-load it. You put it on your card. There's actually a cool little feature where if you set it to auto-boot on your card, you can put the card in, put the lock on the SD card or whatever card you're using for your camera, and it will automatically load it by default. It's non-invasive. It basically runs as a memory resident program, and what it's doing is controlling the microprocessor on your camera, and it basically just tweaks the extra features that you can do. Other really cool things that it can do are, aside from the low shutter speed, it has a much higher shutter speed. So if you have a flash sync thing, you can take like high speed photographs of like water drops, for example.
Oh, very cool.
It has scripting support, so you can set up interval changes for exposure or time-lapse photography. It has a feature that you can do remote control of your camera via the USB interface.
So
things that you couldn't do by default with this little camera.
Tons of stuff.
A $200-$300 camera, and you can just do all these things for it.
Would it make sense for Canon? I mean, would it make sense in general for companies to start releasing easier ways to do more intense things? I mean, the reason why the menu options on that camera are so low, there's two reasons. One is it just gets really confusing for the user, and you want to give the settings and user preferences for the person that's buying the camera to be about what they expect. And on higher-end cameras, more of the features are enabled and it's more complicated. But there is a sweet point there that you want to make it easy. So that's one reason. The other reason Canon might have is they release this camera, and they also release their higher-end cameras, and the higher-end cameras have more features. And so if you want those features, you buy
them. And they share the same processor, core technology, just different software.
Right. Well, sometimes
I wouldn't expect them to do this at all. I mean, a lot of these are designed as point-and-shoot cameras, simple. They're definitely targeting a particular market, so I wouldn't expect them to do this, and it takes all the fun out of it for the
hackers. All right, Ryder, thank you very much for telling us about hacking your phone. That's Ryder Brooks. We also have Miles Elam. I'm Lyle Troxell. We'll be taking your calls in another 10 minutes or so. Miles, your next news story?
Well, first I want to do a correction. Hal from Santa Cruz has told us that he has Creative Zen software, and it's software that allows him to get imports from iTunes. And that would work for presumably his creative media device.
Oh, really? Interesting. So he's able to do that.
Yeah.
To use a different player.
Yeah.
Okay. Speed traps.
Speed traps.
Or let's do Creative Labs.
Okay.
Creative Labs is kind of cool. Speaking about hacking. Creative Labs is a sound company, a manufacturer of sound cards and lots of sound stuff. They've got breakout boards and MIDI controllers, and they're basically a pretty well-known company for making music and sound effects and such of that on your
right,
computer.
But they've got a lot they had a lot of flack their way when people found that their existing creative creative labs
like
equipment,
their drum pad or their USB import drive,
sound cards or external audio devices were found to be less than stellar on Vista. Some of them barely worked. Some of them would cause crashes on Vista. They were not found to be of high quality. And several people have tried to fix this clandestinely outside of Creative Labs control. One of them is a modder who goes by the name of Daniel Kay, who basically decompiled their Vista driver and tried to figure out what was causing a problem and then patched it. And re-released that software on a website, asking for folks saying, like, hey, and anybody wants to help out, feel free. And if you use this, it'll correct some of the problems that you were having with your Creative Labs product. Creative Labs responded by sending a cease and desist.
Wait, did it work? Did the driver crack work and made the applications better, or made the experience better and more stable on Vista?
Yes. They were immensely popular, like 100,000 downloads.
Yes. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Creative Labs sent a cease and desist. Don't do that. That's our property. That's our IP. You are not allowed to do that and redistribute it and modify it.
And then they release it themselves? No. What'd they do?
They simply had it taken down, and that's the end of it.
Okay, so I understand the legal reason why they'd want someone else to not be distributing drivers, and especially their own drivers modified, because if they allow that to happen, they're basically giving up the right to say, we own that. So they have to say that. But to not
then, are they? They're not.
I think so,
because they're not. They're not saying that this. The guy was not saying this is official Creative Labs driver. This is.
Yeah.
I've patched something together.
So you think they could have just let it go and it wouldn't have any legal effect on them?
Well, it's happened with other companies before.
Their argument is that they had intellectual property that, or technology that they licensed from other companies that he was enabling on hardware that wasn't intended for it to be running.
Right, that's
amongst other things. He was also it looks like they were deliberately crippling their drivers for Vista to prevent.
Well, that would be the conspiracy theory behind it.
Not so much to prevent, to promote sales of subsequent hardware.
New hardware.
Right.
Yeah.
Cuz these are drivers that didn't work well with older hardware.
And of course, Creative, they make money on selling the hardware. The software always comes free with the hardware. So to upgrade old hardware to work with Vista doesn't help their business model at all, except for to make their customers more happy with them.
But he found that the drivers were deliberately crippled.
Wow.
The Vista drivers, where they worked fine on XP, he fixed them
and got them released, and they were out there to 100,000 people, so they're clearly never going to go away. So if you've got, you can find people that have these devices and get the driver from them, hopefully.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that Creative did was that they removed all his posts on the forums.
Oh, because it was, of course, their
forums.
And
then they retracted it because there was such a huge outcry over this on the internet that they retracted their...
This kind of thing ticks me off, I mean, if you're going to let go of the hardware, you're going to let go of supporting it, and other people want to pick up supporting it, let it go. Or you're just going to add to the landfills. I mean, that's the truth of the matter is if you can't have that device work on Windows Vista, at some point that device is completely useless and relatively soon.
Which is definitely happening because there are some people who were so upset by the whole affair that they have published photos of their Creative Labs board that they've cut in half or cracked in half as a protest. And there are a lot of people saying they don't want to buy Creative Labs anymore.
Yeah, they just killed themselves on that. Well, who's the competitor? Odigy? No,
Odigy is a Creative Labs product.
Who makes
those? I was actually thinking along the lines of people aren't buying the external board as much anymore. The enthusiasts are, and Turtle Beach is definitely one of their competitors. But a lot of people are just taking the sound that's on their motherboard,
right?
To be completely honest,
like Realtek, the integrated stuff, right?
Yeah,
AC97 stuff, or better.
Okay,
I know that Sean, like NVIDIA, has their board spitting out audio. So
let me do a quick ask. Everybody does, but I'm wondering how many of those chips are actually Creative chips on the board. But that's a possibility as well.
I don't recall.
You don't think so?
Yeah, I don't recall.
It's not that complicated, really. I've always kind of been surprised that there's such a market for high end add on cards. In any case, I want to ask you for helping GeekSpeak. Every week we have to come up with a title for the show. That's for the podcast and everything. And when we have interviews, when I set up interviews and stuff, it's easy. Just name it after the person that's coming there or what they do. It's pretty easy. But when we're dealing with things like geek news, we probably have, I don't know, 40 shows called Geek News. So this week, you got an idea for the show title, let us know. You can send us an email by going to geekspeak.org, and that's when we'll turn on the show notes and everything. I think we've got a time for the breakdown of reality in the form of black holes, Miles?
Well, first of all, the smallest black hole ever was discovered. It's a black hole that was only 3.8 solar masses. In other words, almost four times as large as our sun. But in terms
not as
of,
large, as massive as our sun.
Or as massive, I'm sorry. That one of the big deals about black holes is usually they are very large.
In fact, the largest black hole is billions, like I want to say 4 billion solar masses. That's the largest one we ever found, but go on.
At the center of a galaxy.
I don't know where it is, yeah.
Yeah, all the supermassive ones are usually at the center of a galaxy. That's
sure,
what's
I'll go
usually
that.
Keeping the galaxy.
Well, the problem with the center of the galaxy ones is it's hard to find those because you can deduce because of the way that the system is working, you can deduce there's a black hole there. But to actually get radiation sampling from it is difficult because there's so much other radiation coming.
Right.
But in any case.
Now, just to give you an idea about this, it's almost four times the mass of
our
sun.
Which is really big.
from our point of view, yes, it's rather large. It's a middling-sized star. But this black hole only measures 15 miles across.
And that would be the event horizon, where light cannot escape. So 15 miles across, but four times as massive as the sun.
Right.
Black holes are really dense, man.
So in other words, think of, what, Santa Cruz County or city of Santa Cruz?
No. 15 miles? Yeah, okay.
Somewhere about there.
Yeah. Wow. Now, of course,
and fitting four suns into that space
that's
of mass.
Pretty impressive. We had this whole debate before the show about this. Is like, how big is that? The event horizon is that large, but are we actually talking about infinitely small size that the actual mass is because it breaks down physics?
That's one of the theories about black holes.
But we don't really know.
And we don't know because we can't see there.
It could be
because
a little,
light can't escape.
Right. It could be a little tea party happening there. You don't know. Or a giant sperm whale.
But speaking of black holes, there's been a big hubbub about the
end of the universe or the end of the planet Earth.
Right. A large super collider. Physicists using...
Is that CERN?
No, it's LHC.
LHC? Okay.
LHC. Unfortunately, I've forgotten what LHC stands for. Can someone help me out?
Hadron something?
A giant
Large Hadron Collider.
Where is it?
This is in Europe.
Okay.
Now, this is going to smash things together at a much higher velocity than anything has ever been done before on Earth, that, at least from a man-made standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
And people were worried about, it might create little black holes, and those little black holes might...
In fact, some of the theories say it will, and that's one of the reasons why we're doing it, because we want to see black holes.
That it's going to suck up all the matter, and it's going to destroy the Earth and leave a black hole in its
wake. In Europe. Yeah, who cares?
Well,
the idea
I wanted to address this because there's a lot of this going on because someone has opened up a lawsuit and people are saying, if this is a possibility, then we shouldn't do it.
And we're experts in particle physics, so we're totally afraid.
I'm not an expert in particle physics, but I am reading comments by experts in particle physics.
Good. You're kind of bridging the gap between the geeks
and the rest of humanity. Where the same theories of quantum physics like that say that we're going to be creating tiny black holes or have a possibility for creating tiny black holes also says that those tiny black holes will essentially pop almost immediately due to Hawking radiation. Hawking radiation being a black hole, while it is eating material, also...
And no light can escape.
And past the event horizon, no light can escape, is also emitting matter. Jets of matter.
It's not exactly how it works, but go on.
Well,
what happens is that outside the event horizon, some kind of quantum effects, that whole idea of, I'm guessing here. Let's go with a guess, because that's so much fun, and then somebody that actually knows what they're talking about will tell me.
Okay.
But basically, outside the event horizon...
Black holes lose mass over time.
And they're actually losing energy, and it takes a long time for a large one to go. I wouldn't call it mass, because particles do not leave the event horizon. But what's happening is the energy of the black hole is affecting quantum fluctuations outside the event horizon. Those quantum fluctuations then radiate energy out. And because you cannot create energy, the actual energy to do that is coming from the mass inside the black hole, and so it goes away. Now, in large black holes...
So in other words, the mass is reducing in the black hole.
It is. The mass is reducing in the black hole, but it's because the energy, there's an energy leak, not a mass leak. But, of course, they're equivalent, so it doesn't really matter.
But, yeah, but that's... Okay.
So is this going to suck up all our Starbucks in town?
And no, it won't, because the same theory that says we might create black holes also says that those black holes will evaporate immediately. So you can't say it's going to create a black hole and then completely discount the fact that they're going to evaporate, because the exact same physical model is what predicts both. And
so you're saying it's safe? We're okay? Everything's all right?
And it's safe. Want to bring that up because what most people don't know is that black holes, if you left them alone, they weren't eating, eventually they would disappear. They would evaporate. And also, on a related note, people talk about strangelets, and then strangelets, they're worried about that it's going to change all matter and turn everything else into strangelets. It won't happen. Strangelets, if they do exist, we're not even sure they exist, their electromagnetic charge would repel normal matter.
Right.
So all those folks that are worried about creating small black holes in the end of it's not going to happen. You can rest easy, sleep soundly tonight.
And here's the point.
There's a really bad sci-fi movie about this very same thing.
You know,
with Jed Nelson.
The other night when this news hit, my wife and I were talking about it, and she was kind of concerned about it. I said, you know what? You really don't have to worry about it. She's like, why not? I'm like, well, because it's not going to happen. And if it did happen, it wouldn't really matter. I mean, come on, think about it. We're all gone instantly. Is that sad and depressing? Sure. Does anyone know about it? No.
Now, there's actually been litigation for them to cease progress on this collider because of these issues, though.
Well, someone had brought it up, but the people who brought it up are not people who are understanding the issues. They're
even the physicists can't conclusively say it will or won't happen. Theories. So.
But like as I say, the same model that says they're going to create black holes is the exact same model that says that would evaporate.
I get that.
From Hawking
and at the same time, before we ever did a nuclear detonation, we were concerned that the chain reaction would never actually be contained to the fission material, but that it would just do a chain reaction over the entire planet and the entire planet would go. That was a concern. And
was that the concern evaporating the oceans?
I'm getting there.
Oh, okay.
So that was a concern. And the physicists were like, no, it's not going to be okay. It's going to be okay. If this is going to work at all, this is how it's going to work, blah, blah, blah. And then a secondary concern that people thought about is it's going to be so hot that it will evaporate. It'll burn the atmosphere, which, of course, would also be kind of bad for people that breathe oxygen. Or for anything that uses oxygen. Any case, and that the planet would basically,
the burning, I think, is a bigger issue than the oxygen deprivement. Being without oxygen is a separate thing from being, toasted at a million degrees.
Fine. Okay, I'll go with that. But that was thought about because we understood the idea of combustion.
Isn't this wonderful how we're talking like we know what we're talking about?
It's also wonderful that I need to make... Did we do the break? No, I need to do a break and we're running late, but that's okay. So, but the thing is, that was thought about at least because we understood the idea of burning and that oxygen can, that things do burn. So there's an other idea here is that if you do things that have never been done on Earth before, there's other possibilities. We don't know. Maybe a new particle will exist that will be very unfriendly to matter. We have no idea. I mean, there's other things that could happen in a supercollider, potentially, at these high energy levels that would be different, like starting a new Big Bang. But I think the idea here is that there's too much... And I'm not concerned about it that much, because I think there's very smart people thinking about it. There's a lot of thought going into it, and there's a lot of... So I'm not really that concerned. But at the same time, there is a validity in saying, be careful, you could create something that we can't handle. And I think at some point in the evolution of the species of man and technology, that will happen. And it concerns me that we're so isolated to one planet. I'd prefer, for example, for this thing to be produced on a different outside the Earth.
But isn't that a different that argument about there could be a hypothetical possibility? That sounds to me similar to the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy model of science. If you speak something right now, that it might open up a wormhole to a distant galaxy and start a galactic war.
It's not like that.
That is possible.
Sure. Okay. And your underwear could fly out the window. It's totally possible. And we could lose all audience members in just another 30 seconds. It's totally possible. So, what I'm saying is that if, in fact, this is the highest energy that this planet's ever seen or has seen since the formation of the sun or something like that, if we've never encountered that kind of energy levels, we don't know what will happen. And so there is some unknown. We have some pretty good theories and everything. But I would argue that, yeah, in fact, the Earth has had this kind of energy levels in different ways, and that possibly it's not that much of a concern. But in any case, as promised, GeekSpeak is supported by Business of Pleasure, a full-service business center in Scotts Valley offering computer rentals, printing, design, shipping, delivered office supplies, notary public, and more. Information is online at businesswithpleasure.com. You're listening to GeekSpeak. We're taking your calls with questions about technology. The numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can use the internet. Just go to geekspeak.org. You can participate in our forums, and you can also just send us an email. Stay with KUSP for Castle Cottage this morning at 11 a.m. on Central Coast Public Radio KUSP. You're listening to GeekSpeak. My name's Lyle Troxell. The geeks this morning are Miles Elam and Ryder Brooks. The phone numbers, again, nice and slow, to call us with questions and comments about technology, 476-2800. Again, that's 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-KUSP.
We do have an email we can answer if we don't have any callers.
Oh, well, go for it.
Okay. Anthony Sacco, S-A-C-C-O.
That's okay.
Sacco, okay.
If it's incorrect, you'll be corrected.
He's looking to replace his hard drive on his Mac laptop from the original 120 gigabyte to 250 SATA.
So he's probably dealing with a PowerBook or a MacBook.
Presumably. Mm-hmm. And he has a complication. His current drive is partitioned half with Mac OS.
Half with Vista?
10.4. No.
Oh.
Vista. Uh-huh. No. Half with XP Pro. Oh,
okay.
So, and it's a boot camp partition, and he wants to know how to restore both bits of information onto the new drive without reinstalling both partitions. You ever done that?
No.
Do you think you need some sort of disk cloner?
I would use a disk cloner. On a Macintosh, I use Super Duper, and it would work fine. You get a FireWire enclosure for the new drive. You run your OS currently off the current OS. You run Super Duper on the FireWire drive. It'll get all copied over. And then you do it. But I don't know if Super Duper is going to do a second partition. I think it's only going to be the Mac OS file. So you're going to need something a little more intense than that. You're going to need a real disk duplicator. It's got 120 gigs, and he wants to replace it with a what size?
250.
I mean, since the boot camp is actually a Macintosh, an Apple product, it is possible that using Migrate Assistant will do it. But I'm not sure. Do you know, Miles? I think Migrate Assistant's not an OS thing. It's just all the settings. I think that it's going to be very hard to do that. And, yeah.
I would say at least look at Super Duper. It's free for a full disk backup, and it's supported with Tiger and Leopard now.
Yeah, Super Duper's one. Also, Carbon Copy Cloner is another one.
Yeah, Alex is doubting that Migrate Assistant would do it.
Yeah.
He's wondering about Ghost for the Windows side.
Ghost, but... That's the thing, is you have to use a Windows machine. So what we're talking about is the actual physical hardware. There's actually different partitions. There are different sections of the drive that have been isolated to be a representation of data storage. And those representations are different, and you can't really access them independently necessarily, and it's complicated. And any type of Macintosh, like duplicated cloner thing, will probably only deal with the Mac side that it can see during the time it's running. So an application like Ghost, which basically says, that hard drive, I'm going to take all that content and put it onto another hard drive, and it's not going to even look at what partitions are there. It's just going to do it, and it's going to duplicate, kind of a bit-for-bit thing. But you can also resize the partitions with Ghost, I believe. And if not, that would be kind of a bummer, because then you'd have a 150-gig drive that only has 120 data and usable on it. So
I guess failing that, you could stick both... Take both drives out, put it on a Linux machine, and use like a DD utility.
Yeah, DD.
That would do pretty quick work of it.
Yeah, there you go. Because the thing that's problematic, of course, is since it's a laptop drive, getting the Windows environment, assuming this, he even has a Windows environment anywhere, is going to be difficult. You can't use Ghost on your active boot. So you can't like just boot into Windows and then run Ghost mm-hmm. on the, that won't work. You've got to boot off a different drive. And there you've got, yeah, so that's going to be a little difficult. Yeah.
Actually, DD is not going to be that easy because you're dealing with different partition map
different
size.
Different partition sizes and yeah. map size, yeah. It's not going to be easy. Yeah. Wait, I would argue
as
that...
As soon as you say DD, you know it's not going to be easy.
It's a piece of cake. What are you talking about?
if you help program it.
It's a piece of cake to do very many things with DD. Not all of them good.
You can just grab your system really easy. Yeah. I would suggest... Who's this person? What's this person's name?
Anthony.
Anthony, I might suggest to you to rethink the idea of replacing your hard drive because of needing more space. And make sure that you've got a backup solution that's very viable for both platforms. And if you don't, do that. And then think about archiving as well, which means you have a second set of storage where you put your archived information and you back up that too. Now, that being said, at some time it will fail. So also get into the idea that you better have a really good solution for recovering on Windows. So I guess that's what I'm suggesting is do really good backup on Macintosh, do really good backup on Windows, make sure you've got everything, pull the drive up, put the new drive in, restore those backups, if you will. First, you have to install Boot Camp and make sure the partition spaces are the same, and then just restore from your backups, and that should get you back to speed. And if not, you've got that drive that you haven't touched. How's that one for a solution? And also gets them into a really good backup solution. Okay, well, I'm sure we have calls at this point, so let me make sure that we do through Meebo. Oh, I don't know what's going on. Oh, we've got... Yes, great. Dun, 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 dun. We need some song theme music, Miles. Can you and from Aptos, Elizabeth, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi there. Can you hear me okay?
No problem.
Great. Thanks for taking my call. You know, my favorite book about black holes is that kid's book, A Wrinkle in Time. Remember that?
Wrinkle in Time, yes. Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I have a very simple question. I was going online last night to look into downloading a YouTube video in order to burn it onto a DVD. And so I looked around, and it seemed like the buzz was that Video Download Helper was the best one to do that. I don't know, but when I went on that site and I tried to load that program, a window came up that said safety cannot be determined. Are you sure you want to, you know?
What's this application and how did you find it?
I just Googled downloading or burning a YouTube video onto a DVD or something like that. And a few things came up and then...
Okay, so you did a search for that. Yeah, I think when you do a search for something like that, I'd be concerned a little bit because you can't really trust the provider of that software. What you're asking to do, by the way, is a hack. It's probably against what... YouTube would like you to do.
Oh.
And not saying you should stop because of that, but I'm just saying that be aware that you're being a geek at this point, which is pretty cool.
I do know of another utility that will do it. There's an open source product called Miro. You can go to www.getmiro.com.
M-I-R-O?
Yeah. And one of its features is to save YouTube videos to your disk. To play as regular files. It has other functionality as well, but that is one of the things that it can do. And I've played with that. I know it works. So you're welcome to try that.
I'm glad you told me that because I was thinking, well, I wonder if, you know, Googling something that way could be dangerous.
Yeah, it can. Yeah. Especially if it's something that you'd assume that people would want to do a lot. It's a great opportunity for someone to create an application that will work and also put malware on your machine and, you know, start using your machine as a spam engine.
And Miro is found at getmiro.com, and Miro is spelled M-I-R-O. And I'll put that link up on the website after
great,
the show.
Great.
After we name the show, by the way, we need a name. You got a name for us today?
You could call it Tesseract, which is the word for black hole in Wrinkle in Time. No, I don't know. I didn't come up with anything.
I like. Thank you very much for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Miles, why can't you be that creative?
I don't know. I lack imagination.
From Santa Cruz. Pablo, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello.
Hello, Pablo.
Yes.
Welcome to GeekSpeak.
Thank you. I have a comment and a question,
mm-hmm.
neither of which is worth waiting on hold this long. But since I've already done it, shall I make my comment and question?
Well, no one else knows you've waited on hold that long. So
now they do.
Yes.
My comment is that you guys are creating a black hole of humor.
Oh,
and you've sucked me into it.
Uh-oh.
And I need to know where I can get one of these black hole makers, because I need to get rid of the state bird, which is keeping my ex-wife awake.
Okay, you've lost me in odd metaphor. Wait, first off, is our humor being a black hole, that metaphor means that you're sucked in and you're enjoying it, or you're sucked in and trapped behind the event horizon?
Both.
Oh, my goodness. And the state bird is keeping you awake?
The state bird is keeping my ex-wife awake, which is even worse.
Well, why is that worse? Do you live with your ex-wife?
No.
Problem solved.
But she can't respond to the mating call. And it's keeping her awake, and I'm sure it would...
Well, that's really interesting. So you're thinking that there's a male bird or a female bird, and it's calling for a mate, and it's not finding one. And so if you could maybe emulate the sound of the mate, it would solve the problem.
Well, either that, or if she could only fly out there and investigate, but I don't
okay,
know.
I suggest earplugs, but thank you so much for the call.
You're welcome.
Take care. The phone numbers, by the way, though Pablo waited a long time, you don't have to. There's nobody in the queue right now. So if you know the phone number, call it. If you don't know the phone number, try 476-2800. Again, that's 476-2800. We are answering any questions and comments about technology today. You can also try 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's a toll-free number. How nice of us, huh? 1-800-655-KUSP. Well, we are waiting for calls at this point, so why don't we do some more news? Miles, you got a whole lot of news, and one that I wanted to touch on and we didn't. Was what? Speed traps. Phones. Tell us more about... So we talked a lot about like GPS and phones. We covered this before, the idea that you could get traffic alerts based on where you are and you can get direction, and there's some really neat features. And this sounds kind of interesting.
Now there's a service being put up called... They're calling Trapster.
Wait, is it just an R at the end and not an ER? Well, we'll put it up on the site.
No, it's Trap, S-T-E-R, you know, Trapster.
Okay.
Where they're looking to warn fellow drivers of a cell phone and warn with a cell phone about police speed traps or red light cameras or what's being described here as other threats to ticket-free driving.
And getting one of away, the ways it's getting away with breaking the law is what you're saying?
Well, is it breaking the law?
To know where speed traps are? Well,
right,
it's breaking the law to do anything that is... what speed traps would catch you on.
Police officials that one of the developers of the system has talked to have said, haven't complained about it. Because as far as they're concerned, they're like, okay, it means people are going to be slowing down.
Yeah, but only around them.
But then again, they're going to be looking at areas, they're going to be sitting around in areas where things are, people are going to be speeding the most. So if it's going to encourage people to slow down, they're fine with it.
I'm sorry, but if I'm told, if a person that speeds, which actually I don't do very often, if a person speeds and they know where the speed traps are, and then they slow down during those periods, and then they keep going, they will not get a ticket, and therefore they will not change their driving style. So now they're just getting away with driving recklessly.
But what if the point of the speed trap is to get people to slow down near, for example, a school? It's
okay.
A localized
you know what,
issue.
Though,
then
that's
slowing
not,
down is the
that's
solution.
Not what the point of a speed trap is. The point of the speed trap is to get people for speeding, to give them tickets so that they rethink their driving pattern and so that they slow
I
down
it was
in
a
general.
Money generation scene.
It's a money generation, too, for the city, of course. Yeah. Like the one at the bottom of the campus that gets trapped.
Why
everybody.
Am I being attacked for this?
You're being
just,
attacked
I'm reporting
for this you're
the story
it,
that the police officials
you're
aren't
defending
all that
it,
concerned
Miles.
About.
You like people to speed. So the way this works is you get a GPS and cell phone thing and you subscribe to the service. And as you drive around, anything that's near you that's a speed trap, you get a warning about.
Yeah, other drivers would tap
another
in,
drive, and you,
tap
you as a
it,
user
then,
would start tapping in, so you'd have to kind of watch. I'm curious, though, because it basically means people are going to spend more time on their phone.
I think we're talking about
accidents.
The same thing that truckers use over CB radios, warning each other where
sure.
the police might be, where they can speed, you know,
right.
so that we can get our Amazon products
also,
that much faster.
GPS providers, user communities, you can upload cash points or maps onto your GPS that show you speed trap areas. Sort of a user-contributed
so same
database.
Same thing,
yeah,
really. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much for that. From Santa Cruz, Eric, welcome to... No, I'm sorry. Oh, yes, Eric, welcome to Geek Speak.
Yeah, hi. I know a few months back, or maybe not that quite long, you were going to compare the low-cost Intel laptop with the other world low-cost laptop that was supposed to come out, the $200 laptop.
Sure, for, yeah.
And did you guys ever do that? Or
Well, yeah, we can talk a little bit about that. I finally did get in the XO laptops, the one laptop per child laptops for UCSC research, was able to play with them. And I haven't seen, Miles, you've seen the low-cost Intel laptop. Has it actually been released? Or they're just still in design phase?
They have been released, but I haven't actually played with
them. We haven't
played
with them.
And they're also, but there's they're also not designed the ASUS for EEE.
And these laptop ones, though, are not designed for children, correct? Those laptops?
Right. They're, okay, they're simply so scaled down adult laptops.
Here's the deal with the Windows, the one laptop per child laptop. This is not a laptop for a average adult hand. You can't really use it effectively. The keyboard's, I would say, two-thirds the size of a keyboard that we normally use. And because of that, because of the lack of its support for adults, it really is a great great machine for kids. So additionally, the low-cost quality of it, I mean, in the U.S., you have to spend about $400 to get one. That's because you actually have to buy two, and one goes to a child somewhere that needs it. So there's some good aspects to that. Now, the Intel and what was the other company, Miles, you mentioned that was doing it?
ASUS.
ASUS is doing it. These low-cost machines are going to be viable as for a user, to an adult to use. And I would say that if you're looking for a low-cost laptop, and you don't care about performance, like you don't want to edit video, you don't want to even maybe, well, that's pretty much what you couldn't do on it. You can't game on it. I would go with one of these, ASUS or Intel. And are you saying, Miles, and maybe we don't know, but are you saying that they're stocked right now in stores?
I know the ASUS one has been getting a lot of press lately, and people have been buying them with differing results. Some people like them, some people don't. The Intel one I haven't really followed at all.
Eric, does that answer your question?
Yeah, thanks a lot. I haven't heard about the ASUS one. How do you spell that?
ASUS, the company is ASUS, and the laptop is the E. I don't know how to pronounce it. It's three E's.
Okay. Do you know what it retails for, by any chance?
We actually shouldn't really cover retail costs on public radio.
Oh, okay,
but
great.
It's under $1,000, and it's over $50. It's completely useless for you.
Yeah, well, the reason I'm asking is because several senior friends that they just need it for internet access.
Okay, so you do this then. Get a used laptop because you're going to spend even maybe less on a used laptop. I would go up to Craigslist and look around for a laptop and get one of those instead. The only thing was you probably have to reinstall Windows. You might have to put a new hard drive in it. But you can get a lot. You can get a cheap machine that's actually pretty powerful by getting like a four-year-old machine. Right, or do you agree? You're kind of going, about that one.
It depends. I mean, I would question the really small display on these EEE PCs, you know, in terms of visibility, because what, they're like 6-7 inches,
right? And that's why I'm suggesting. That's why I'm suggesting getting
visibility is an issue if you're targeting these towards
senior citizens. Yeah,
yeah. You know, it's
and that's kind of why I'm suggesting don't get a small brand new one. Get a cheap used one.
Yeah, but I mean,
because it's got a bigger screen.
There's positives and negatives. I mean, it's extremely portable. The battery life is going to be good.
Eric, do you have a laptop right now?
No, I don't.
Okay. So it's always fun to visit Craigslist.com and take a look at the Bay Area, South Bay Area. I'm not sure exactly where we classify in that.
My problem is I'm so illiterate computer-wise that...
Yeah, that is a difficulty. I get that. And that, how do you know if that laptop's worth any money at all? Can it run anything?
Exactly. I've gotten laptops used like that, and they work for about a week, and then it costs more to have them repaired than what they paid for.
That's true, and the repair costs, you know, are pretty high, you know, almost $100 an hour kind of thing to repair a laptop. It just seems like such a great way to help people out by using – there's so many laptops out that are just sitting in people's houses. What, you know, the other thing to do is just start asking around, especially if you've got a user group or something. Does anyone have an old laptop I can have? So that's to some degree a way to go. The next thing is it seems like a really good fit for like electronic repair shop place to say, we'll take in these laptops and give them to people in need, if you will, or give them into a pool that will be used in a place where a lot of people live. It just seems like such a good use. I think the Grey Bears used to do this kind of thing. Well, that's enough going on about things I don't know. Eric, good luck on your purchase. You can also do this, and I'd be happy to do this for you. If you want to go up at Craigslist, look around for a laptop, find something at the right price, and send us an email with a link. We'll tell you if it's worth it or not. I'm happy to do that. Just go to geekspeak.org and there's a contact form, or you can actually participate in the forums, and we can just, all of us can kind of find laptops and post things and kind of chat about it that way. That'd be great.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Eric. If you've got an old laptop and you want to give it away, maybe the GeekSpeak forums are the right way to kind of suggest that. We'll have a little chat about it. From Salinas, I want to invite Amber. Welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi, guys. I want to transfer my music to DVDs or, you know, the latest thing. And I wonder, what is the device called that enables you to do that? I'm told that... there's a device or a machine that you can buy that will digitize your tapes and vinyl, et cetera.
It would be different machines, but your VHS tapes to DVD?
No, she's talking about
audio
tape.
Yeah, audio tapes.
I'm not familiar with one for audio. For records, there are a couple out there. There's one that Sony makes, and there's one called Ion, which is pretty affordable. I've actually seen it at sale at like Costco and other online retailers.
Ion, you say?
Yeah, Ion.
Uh-huh.
That's probably one of the more affordable ones. I recently saw one that Sony made, but it was a little bit more expensive. For tapes, you can actually get away with using your existing tape player and hook it up to your sound card if you have a sound card on your computer, and using some software to transfer that. Lyle, most of you guys
have what software is that?
For transferring stuff. There.
Well, it's not really the transfer. I mean, the transfer has to do with the hardware thing.
Well, to facilitate the transfer.
Yeah.
Roxio.
Well, I'm basically illiterate.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a kind of all-in-one bundled software called Roxio.
Roxio.
That will do that.
Toast is the application, I think.
For Macintosh.
Yeah.
For PC, I think it's just called Roxio.
Yeah, and most of these come... Any CD burning software actually normally comes with some kind of importing tools. You do have to connect it, though. And the question, do you have mostly albums, mostly tapes, or a mix of both?
A mix.
Okay, so you can buy like a USB turntable, which basically is like a traditional record player that has a USB cable you plug in your computer, and those things actually come with software to help you convert your vinyl to your computer format. And that's, I think, a really good option for vinyl, because the connections of taking the output of your record player through your sound system into your computer, there's a bit of cabling issues, and just doing it direct is nice. It's also, most of the time, people don't have their... I mean, it's very common for people not to have their album, their player still working. But if you're listening to albums regularly, you might not want to purchase another one.
Yeah. With record players in particular, you have that grounding loop problems.
Yeah.
And
Can you repeat that, please? What do you call it? What's the term for it?
USB turntable. A USB turntable.
That was what I was talking about, Ion.
Yeah, Ion, USB turntable.
Okay. Where would I find this?
We can put a link up on the website. We've actually done it in the past, but I'm sure that one of us will get a link up pretty quick for you. So just go to geekspeak.org with your web browser in a little bit, and it'll be up there.
Believe it or not, I actually saw the USB turntables at the local Circuit City.
Well, they're
actually mass market.
Yeah. Mass market.
Yeah, and I saw them at Costco. So
there you go. You can go to any retail stores as well.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for the call. And thanks for listening to GeekSpeak. To those that called in, we do appreciate your participation. Without you, it would just be us geeking out, and who wants to listen to that? GeekSpeak is supported by Business with Pleasure, a full-service business center in Scotts Valley. Wait a second. I already read that. They are great and all that, but GeekSpeak is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission. The geeks today were Miles Elam and Ryder Brooks. Thank you both for joining me.
Sure. Thank
Always
you.
Always a pleasure.
Answering the phone, as we have every week, is Rick Philman. Thank you, Rick, so much. Broadcasting HD radio on 88.9 FM. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, KBDH San Auto, or on the web at kusp.org. For KUSP and GeekSpeak, I'm Lyle Troxell. See you next week. You just listened to another episode of GeekSpeak via our podcast. Would you do us a favor? Please go to your favorite podcasting index site, whether it be iTunes, Dig.com, Odeo, or another site, and write a review or give us a vote to let others know what you think about GeekSpeak. Thanks, that'd really help us out. GeekSpeak is supported by PreownedCar.com, PreownedCar.com, where anyone can post their vehicle for sale or browse to purchase a pre-owned car from other car owners. More information available at PreownedCar.com. This is Lyle Troxell for KUSP. Thanks for listening.